The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Governor Ridge has served many roles, and I think that's one of the great gifts that he brings to us is a perspective. Native of Erie, a graduate of Harvard and Dickerson College of Law, he served as an assistant district attorney. He served his country as a Vietnam veteran. He has served in Congress as a congressman, and perhaps for all of us, served as the governor of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. From there, he was called to Washington by President Bush to head up the Homeland Security. And that experience has informed Governor Ridge and influenced what he has had to say about this book, America Under Siege, and How We Can Be Safe Again. So please join me in a wonderful Philadelphia welcome for Governor Tom Ridge, who will answer your questions and tell us how we can be safe again. Governor Ridge.
Thank you. Well, thanks very much, folks. Thank you very, very much. It's nice to be back home in Pennsylvania. I want to assure you I kept my residency here, so I want them to get over this budget impasse as well. I'm still a citizen. Where's the emergency management team from Philadelphia? Back there? I know what you do. I know how hard you work. Thanks for joining us tonight. By the way, I've got an idea in my book that says we ought to dedicate some broadband to public safety. Maybe we'll call it the Heroes Network so you and your colleagues, the police and fire, can be able to get access to data, video, and voice all in the same system. So maybe one of these days we'll get it. Thanks for your work. Thanks. All right. Well, it's a great pleasure as a first-time author to actually have an invitation from such a prestigious and wonderful institution like the Free Library that Ridge guy is coming back, wants to talk about his book, and have people show up. So thank you for being here. Thank you for being here. It was a great journey that I've led in public service. I've done a lot of very interesting things. Soldier, prosecutor, congressman, governor, assistant to the president, secretary of a cabinet agency, and it's been a great ride. And the termination of that service was in the Department of Homeland Security, but it's some of those perspectives and experience that shaped my views on events and my approach to things after the president called me and asked me to come to Washington. And so I hope if those of you who choose to read the book, take that journey with me, that you are convinced at the end of the day, there are a couple of things, that it's a thoughtful reflection of what I did, accounting the environment within which we worked, the challenges we faced. They were never personal, but there were a lot of institutional challenges, I assure you. Not personal, but institutional, big government, people pushing back all over the place. That we had some successes. I talk about a few missteps that I made. It's uncharacteristic in Washington for anybody who said they made a mistake or two. I assure you, your safety wasn't jeopardized, but a couple of things, particularly on the public front that I had to do all over again, I would have done differently. Talk a little bit about unfinished business. And I'd like to think maybe some thoughts about the way ahead for the country to take longer term to kind of undermine that poisonous ideology that unfortunately is appealing to people that will fly airplanes into tall buildings and will strap bombs to their chest and waist and kill innocent people. So it's a journey, and I'll take it with you. I hope to make it, hope you think it's educational and informative. I have to tell you that included in the book, I have some of the best lines that I heard from the late night talk show host about duct tape and the color-coded threat warning system, a couple of my favorites in there. I think you got to talk about tough issues from time to time with humor, and you should never lose your sense of humor. And frankly, I wish there was more humor invested in politics and not of ridicule, but just legitimate fun. I'm a little provocative. I say some things that some people might push back on, but that's all right. The president called me when I was holding what I consider to be the best job in America, governor of Pennsylvania. I love being your governor, trust me. But I was also in the back of that Chinook going into Shanksville that afternoon of July 11th. And like all of you had seen on TV scenes of commercial aviation accidents. And I expected to see a lot of debris when I got there. There was none. Just a big smoldering hole, very little debris, as if the plane tried to bury itself in the earth. A couple days later, Mrs. Bush came by, and we had the memorial. And I remember saying to her as she left, because the president and I have been friends for a long time, still are friends, talked a couple times over the past couple months. I said, well, you know, and I'm making this, I'm sure everybody had a chance to talk to the president or the vice president or anybody else. Anything I can do to help, let me know. I didn't think there's anything I could do to help, but I think he ought to know that if there's anything I could do, I'd be happy to do it. I don't ever think that Mrs. Bush, Laura, conveyed that to the president, but a couple days later, I get the phone call, his governor, and I remember Andy Card and the vice president were on the line. They said, the president would like to talk to you tonight. Think about organizing an office in the White House. He wants to talk to you about filling it, and he'll give you more details later. I said, great, happy to talk to my friend, but I've got to go to a funeral home first because a close friend of mine died. I want to pay my respects, so he called me after 9, probably the only time I ever told the president what to do. And he called. We had the conversation. The next day we met. I agreed to take it, and the rest is history. There were occasions that I felt, and incidents that I felt during this journey of 3.5 years, almost 4 years in Washington, that might be helpful and informative to you as a citizen to explain a little bit about the environment, introduce you to a couple of rather remarkable people. I wish I could have identified 30 or 40 or 50 or more. I dedicate the book to the people I worked with, a rather remarkable crowd, but I'm going to introduce you to a couple of them. I had people come out of retirement. A couple people were in the military, came over. A couple people took huge, huge pay cuts and said, okay, country's at war, and the great capabilities of our military and their problem-solving inclination. A couple of them retired, good jobs, consulting jobs, and they said, hey, we're at war. I'm putting a uniform on. I'm coming back in. I want to help Ridge. It's a really remarkable crowd. You're going to meet some of them in the book. I think you'll enjoy them. Some people have misinterpreted or they've decided to put their own spin on some of the things I said in the book, and I'm going to tell you right now, no one at any time during my tenure in Washington ever pressured me or anybody else to raise the threat level. I say that earlier in the book. I said it when I was secretary. I identified the process when I was secretary and did all kinds of talk shows. I'm not sure anybody was listening. But here's how the system worked. And it's relevant because I want to talk to you about something that dramatic. Everybody focused on the colors, right? We guess it could have been colors. It could have been numbers. It could have been letters of the alphabet. We chose colors. And I think people were so inclined to kind of poke fun at the colors, there were two other things that they never paid attention to, even though we kept telling America. The first is each one represented a very specific level of preparedness. At each level, you were to do certain things, governors, mayors, private sector. So it was like a traffic light. This color, you're supposed to do certain things. That was always missed in the discussion. But even more important in the discussion was what had to happen to raise the threat level. The president, for lack of a better words, had a Homeland Security Council. Secretaries of Defense, Homeland Security, State, CIA Director, FBI Director, a couple of others. Pretty thoughtful, smart, strong-willed people. You get the picture. You know who they are. In my intelligence chief, and we only had a small shop, we were a consumer of intelligence. We didn't generate much. Twice a day, he would have secure video conferences with his colleagues and other in the intelligence agency, because you're constantly churning the information you're getting, electronic intercepts, off-the-street threats. You pick it up here. You got interrogation. It goes on and on. So you're constantly churning. What's real? What's not real? What should be shared? What should be further investigated? So at the end of the day, it gets to a certain level sometimes, and you never knew about it, that the principals would be called together. The reason you didn't know about it, because more often than not, we were called together. We looked at the information. We said, no, not yet, not ready. You don't raise it. I assure you, if you go back and look at the history in Google, we raised it three or four times. We always had the principals meet. And the notion was, if you had a consensus within that group, then you would go up. But no consensus, you didn't raise the threat level. You'll never read about the times we met and said, no, not justifiable, can't do it. Now, as someone who's secretary, I have to deal with the consequences, the mayors, the governors, the police chiefs, and everybody else, if we decide to go up, because that means more security, a real challenge for the country, emotionally, psychologically, financially. And so I'm very sensitive to going up. But if the intelligence warrants it, if the information warrants it, people make their decision on what they think is the best interest of the country, we go up. The passage in the book that I think is particularly poignant, and I point out the process, is Election Eve 2004. A very dramatic time. I even use the word dramatic. Think about this. Principals are meeting. This time it's video conference. Secure. Everybody's in their offices. We're in our little office room in the office of Homeland, Department of Homeland Security. And there's a general consensus that we don't go up, but two men whose opinion I respect and everybody else's respect want to go up. I'm not here. The Attorney General and the Secretary of Defense. We don't go up. The process works. It always worked well. And in the book, I muse at the end. I'm the author. I'm allowed to think whatever I want to think and put some thoughts on paper. They were really serious about going up. Is it politics? Is it security? I don't understand why they want to go up. I'm not second-guessing them, but remember, this is the same year that an election, and a democratically held election in our ally of Spain was affected by a terrorist attack a couple days before the election. This is at the same time we're looking at a bin Laden tape. This is the same time that the commentators, the pundits, the politicos are saying, geez, with that tape, are they going to postpone the election? Would it be a good idea to take the threat level up so people feel more secure about going to vote? I don't know what's musing in anybody's mind. I'm just saying, is it politics or security? I'm glad we didn't go up. I didn't want to go up. And by the way, we didn't go up. Now, I did make a mistake earlier that year in August of 04. You probably remember it. The group met. We decided to go up. The Pakistani Intelligence Service. We found video surveillance tapes on a hard drive. A couple buildings in northern New Jersey, a couple buildings in New York City, a couple in Washington, D.C. That group met, video conference, if I recall correctly. We all looked at it and we said, yeah, the tape may be old, but as one of the CEOs said to me, it's not old to me. It's my building. They're my employees. It's my town. We want to know about it. And so we took the threat up, and everybody made the adjustments, and everybody, frankly, went to work that day, the following day. But when I announced it at the last minute, after we made the decision to go up, no pressure, no politics, the decision was made, I lauded my friend, the president, in my remarks. Thanks to the president's leadership, blah, blah, blah. Now, I had never done it before. I'd gotten a memo or an email or something from the White House saying, well, why don't you, you know, it is election season. Why don't you put something in there nice about the president? I wasn't thinking. I threw it in. It became the sideshow. The decision had been made to go up for very good reasons. But for the next couple of weeks, people said, aha, you raised the threat level politically. No, that decision had been made. That decision had been made. And if I had to do it all over again, I don't include the president's name, because it distracted from the substance of the intelligence and the importance of going up. So to a certain extent, I created that, the misimpression. So it's my fault. The responsibility is on my shoulders, not the author of the memo. We did a lot of good things. A great group of people worked with me. In a couple of week period before we went into Iraq, you didn't see much of it. We built something called Liberty Shield. The whole country did, not just Homeland Security, but there's more security in place because we thought there would be reprisals. Ultimately, there are no one, but I talked to you a little bit about that in the book. You're going to get a sense of some frustrations that I had that, again, are not personal. Sharing information in the Cold War era was really done on a need-to-know basis. The enemies are countries. Our country's not the battlefield. Law enforcement, the intelligence community, when the public needs to know, we'll kind of tell you, but it's a different era. After 9/11, not only did I think the culture needed to change regarding that threat, not only need to know, but we need to share more with the public, with mayors, police chiefs, governors. So you'll get a sense in there, because I referred to it a couple of times, when trying to create, to affect a change in that culture. There were some other institutional challenges, because we're about ready for the kickoff of the college and National Football League season. I would say to you, those of you that are football fans, it would be as if the NFL said, next season, you can have 12 on offense and 12 on defense. Now, what do you think that does with the head coach or the offense and defensive coordinators? You got a new player. Where do you slot them? What are the responsibilities? Who's responsible for the communication? How do you deal with the salary cap? There's a lot of things going on there. So, in a sense, we are the new department, trying to build our own bona fides internally, trying to reorganize an agency at the same time we're trying to build platforms for safety and security, and earning our stripes with the rest of the agencies in town. There's a great scene in the book, I'll never forget it. When I was in the White House, one of our missions was to create a national strategy, which was really part of the blueprint for the department. And part of the blueprint ultimately led to creating the blueprint was the department. And I remember trying to affect those changes just by moving some budget items around, trying to build a smaller agency, and get my cabinet getting everybody to kind of buy into it. Because people have been talking about America having a border-centric agency for 20, 30, 40 years. And there are probably 8 or 10 studies over the past 50 years about, because it's a global world, why don't we have people monitoring the goods and services and people coming across our borders? Makes sense, doesn't it? Sure. Well, we never did it. So I remember getting the cabinet together, again, the President's Homeland Security cabinet, and suggesting this idea, and nobody thought it was a good idea. Well, Governor, we need better communication, better coordination, blah, 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 but that's a bad idea. Paul O'Neill was supportive, and Paul always thought the government was operating in the 19th century anyhow, and anything we could do to improve its efficiency or try to do better would be okay with him. So, obviously, without any support, there wasn't much support on the Hill. A couple months later, flash forward, we're back in the Roosevelt Room, right out the Oval Office. The same people were there. The same crowd had said, all we need to do is better coordination, better communication. There's one other person in the room. He's sitting next to me, President of the United States. He said, I'm glad you all got together here today. I'm just going to let you know that we're going to create a border-centric agency. These aren't his words, they're mine. But we're going to create this new agency. We're going to call it Department of Homeland Security. And would you be surprised to learn that everybody thought it was a pretty good idea? Were there challenges to organizing? You bet. Did we do a perfect job? No. Is there still work to be done? Yes. But when you get done reading the book, I hope I can convince you that the threat is real. Our enemies do not set their watches according to the Western clocks. I'm going to be at Shanksville on September 11th. I'm the honorary co-chair of the National Fundraising Campaign for the Flight 93 Memorial. It will be the 8th anniversary of 9/11. Ironically, that's the number of years that passed between the two attacks on the World Trade Center. They're patient, strategic in their thinking. I believe we're still in the crosshairs. I also believe we shouldn't be breathless about it. It's a new threat. We're better prepared. There are more dots that we're connecting. The intelligence is getting more information, more support overseas in terms of law enforcement and intelligence, more and better trained people up and down the line. FBI is the point of our counterterrorism effort. I mean, a lot of things are different and better, but we still have some unfinished work. And I talk about that in the book. And one final thought, and we'll open it up because I think the Q&A period will be much more interesting. I met Benazir Bhutto. You probably are familiar with her, leader of democracy, a particular group of those Democrats, small d, in India, assassinated. I met her a couple months before she was assassinated. And in preparation of meeting her, I read some of her speeches. And I read a line that I'll never forget, and it said, you can exile a man but not an idea. You can imprison a man but not an idea. You can kill a man but not an idea. Think about that for a moment. We certainly do need a military dimension to combat the terrorists. We spend a lot of blood and treasure in the process. But I suggest in the book that we also have to expand the military dimension to other ways of undermining that idea. We have to figure out ways to work with the Muslim world. By the way, do you know it's 1.3 billion people plus out there? Most Americans don't know that. Most Americans think Muslims only live in the Arabian Peninsula. But if you spin the globe, they're everywhere. As a matter of fact, there was a Gallup poll taken over a six-year period in the Muslim world. And you're going to be surprised to learn, if you believe in polls, I don't care what the margin of error is, but they published their results, is that in the Muslim world that they at least polled, there are certain things about America they like. They like this notion of self-government. Maybe not quite the institutions we have, but democracy is appealing to them. Our technology certainly is. The poll said they really valued our freedom of speech. So there's a basis to work on. We don't know too much about their world, and they don't know too much about ours. But as we go about trying to figure out how we can reduce the threat, because I don't think we'll ever be able to eliminate it, we have to make sure that we have to do our best to convince the rest of the world, hopefully with help of Muslim leaders and clerics, and I think they have a responsibility to help us, that Al-Qaeda and the terrorists, their thought process, their ideology, their plan has nothing to do with improving the human condition of their fellow Muslims. First of all, most of the majority of the victims of the terrorist attack over the past several years have been Muslims in the name of some righteousness. And there's nothing in their creed, nothing in their dogma, nothing in their recruiting that says, come with us, we want a better way. We want to improve the human condition. And so we have to think about how we take some of these notions and turn it into a strategy that will always have a military dimension, but may have a public diplomacy dimension, may have a foreign aid, God forbid foreign aid. Ah, we got to spend that money here. Well, you know what, folks? Foreign aid directed at the right place is a good investment long term for America. Some people disagree with me, but you're entitled to that. But if you saw the last couple of scenes in Charlie Wilson's War, he's in front of the intelligence community. They've already invested hundreds of millions of dollars. We gave the Mujahideen money to defeat the Russians. In the middle of the Cold War, the Russians pull out, and he's back in saying, okay, they're out. We need to go in. We need to build roads. We need to build schools. And they say to him critically, who do you think you are, the congressman from Kabul? I don't know. What happens if they give them a couple hundred million dollars? They know it's coming from America. Maybe we do it through the NGOs. And you start building roads and schools. We left a vacuum, and who filled the vacuum? The Taliban filled the vacuum. So I have some suggestions as to what we might do. And at the end of the day, I'm quite confident. Accept the risk is real. Understand that we're far better prepared today than we were before. There is some unfinished business. Accept the notion that we cannot eliminate it completely, but every day we can get closer to being better prepared and certainly better prepared to respond to something if it happens. And at the end of the day, we don't live in fear in America. Never have, we never will. It's just not our nature. At the end of the day, Homeland Security is about balancing our need to protect both the tangible, life, property, things, people, places, things, stuff, and the intangible, privacy, civil rights, the value system, and do that in the context of the America that we know and cherish. So at the end of the day, I think we prevail. We don't live in fear. We live in freedom. The test of our times isn't concluded. We'll continue to find ways and be challenged to figure out how do we protect the tangible and the value system. That's our brand. We don't want to undermine that brand. And I think we'll be able to accomplish it, and hopefully you'll take the journey, fascinating journey. I found it that way if you decide to read the book. I'm grateful to the opportunity to share these couple of thoughts with you, and more often than not, I find in audiences the conversation gets even more interesting if you let the audience ask questions. So I guess that's what we'll do right now. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Governor Ridge. And as he said, we'll turn it over to you for questions. Please keep your questions brief. I have a feeling we'll have many of them. Gentleman in the yellow and white stripe, please wait for the microphone, sir.
First of all, thank you, Governor Ridge, for all you have done to help keep America safe. My question refers to former Vice President Cheney, who has recently said the country is less safe under President Obama than it was under President Bush. Would you care to comment on his thoughts?
Sure. Rare do I miss the opportunity to comment. A couple of things have been going down the past couple of the days that I think are kind of intriguing. Number one, I really admire General Jones. I know him well. But when he said the other day that President Obama has done more in 7 months than President Bush did in 7 years, I just tell you, I can't buy that. I think it's absurd, number one. I think President Obama, in many sense, operationally, has continued many of the things. I think Secretary Napolitano has continued some of those things and should be praised for it. But I understand a national security advisor should come to defense of his president. I think there's a little hyperbole there. What has troubled me more than anything else, because I think on an operational basis, they're at least at the same level. But what's problematic for me is the notion that we might go back potentially and prosecute individuals who interrogated prisoners because we decided 4 or 5 years afterwards it was the wrong thing to do, perhaps even unlawful, perhaps even criminal, after they were told that's their job and these techniques are permissible. Now, I'm flat on the record. I think waterboarding's torture. It was banned finally under the Bush White House. It may be it's inappropriate. I never felt it. But I don't think anybody involved in waterboarding ought to be prosecuted. This president won. He ran a vigorous and incredible campaign, and he's entitled to set whatever parameters or guidelines he wants as he tries to deal with terrorism. He's allowed to set whatever guidelines he wants for the interrogators. But to go back and second-guess these men who, in the aftermath of 9/11, did what they were supposed to do using the techniques that they were told were authorized, I think is wrong. I don't think too much about sleep deprivation as being a bad thing. Oh, it's torture. I bet you could probably find somebody in your neighborhood, a mom or two had a couple of colicky kids who were up all night for 3 or 4 days in a row. That's torture. But, I mean, look, sleep deprivation is most of those things that they talked about, I don't find. I mean, discharging a firearm in the room next door, is that torture? No, waterboarding, my judgment, is torture. No question about it. It's wrong. It's been barred. But I don't think we ought to go back and relitigate that. But if President Obama and his team want different interrogation guidelines, they are certainly entitled to set them. He won the election. But I think it's wrong to go back and prosecute these men.
Another question. Lady on the aisle here. If you could wait for the mic.
Along those lines, do you believe that it would be improper if there were an investigation into anything that happened during your tenure?
Adam, you're going to have to. I didn't hear the question.
Along those lines, do you think there would be anything improper investigating?
Pardon me? It's pretty much an open book. I mean, what my department did, we weren't involved in any interrogation. You know, we've got, you know, one of the things, one of our strengths of our government, candidly, and people don't appreciate, I talk a little bit about it, but we investigate ourselves all the time. It's called the Office of Inspector General. It's very interesting. In the letter I point, in the book I point out that after the Patriot Act was passed and national security letters were approved, the Office of the Inspector General of the FBI came forward with a report and said, you know, some of the guidelines and practices have been violated. Now, it wasn't any big public, there wasn't any public inspection, no investigation, but the person in charge with making sure that performance complied with the law came forward and said, you're not doing it right. Bob Mueller changed the practice. So, I think it's one of the strengths of our system. We don't really appreciate that. It's like, I mean, I took umbrage from time to time when, particularly early on, we were setting up the department. And I say this respectfully to any journalist that around, but the notion that they tried to break in and, you know, there's one incident, I think, where somebody took a boat and got access to a airport across a harbor and managed to get on the airlines. We check ourselves from security all the time. TSA is checked all the time. Sometimes you learn about it, some not. We're constantly probing ourselves for safety and security reasons. But to your point, I think it's a fair one, we're also constantly overseeing what we do to make sure that the practices authorized by the Congress are not violated. And when they are, that's where the Inspector General gets involved. And should get involved. That's their job.
Lady on the aisle in the blue there.
Governor, hi. You mentioned that there's still unfinished business. If you could sort of tell us what the number one thing on that unfinished business list would be that you would like to make finished.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a list, and since many of them are policy decisions, let me just tell you what a couple of them are. I'm serious when I think that the recommendation of the 9/11 Commission about creating a network of communication for our police and fire and emergency service personnel has lingered and gathered dust in the 9/11 report for like 6 years. I think it's unconscionable because the technology is there. We got to do it. Unfinished business. And one of the reasons we do it, and it's kind of interesting, if you make the right investments, primarily as a result of 9/11, you add value elsewhere. So if you have a public safety network, you do it not because you think, just because you think there's another terrorist attack, but what if there's a huge mass casualty incident? What if there's an accidental spill of some chemical somewhere? All of a sudden, it's not just security, but your communities become a little bit safer because your emergency service personnel, your hospital personnel, everybody involved in that can finally communicate and not run into the problems there. We need to finish the U.S. visit system. When I was secretary in the enabling legislation that created the department, they said, Secretary, we want an entry-exit system. Think about this. We've had people coming back and forth across our borders. Every country does. But since for 20 or 30 years, people were saying we need to do a little bit more than looking at their passports. A couple of the hijackers came into this country lawfully with visas, but their visas were expired, but we had no record of the expiration. So if you don't know they're here illegally, you're certainly not going looking for them. So we said U.S. visit, and here's what we do. If you're coming in from a foreign country, visa waiver or not, we take your photograph, digital photograph. We get a couple fingerprints from you, and that says, okay, that's citizen of a foreign country. We've got your photograph. We've got a couple digits. We kind of know who you are. Now, on your way out the door, we want to match your photograph and your fingerprints with our database to make sure you're left. Well, it's been 4+ years. We still haven't got the mechanism in place to see if you left. Coast Guard. Anybody here serving the Coast Guard? I'm going to tell you, I'm a groupie. I admit it. I plead guilty. I think the men and women of the United States Coast Guard are the most underrated, under-resourced, multitask organization in government, and they do not get the money they need for equipment and personnel. And the problem is they don't complain. I'll give you an example. The G8 was meeting in Sea Island, Georgia. We're in charge of security. So I go down there, hop in a helicopter, and on the way back, we're flying around a little bit. Trust me, you wouldn't want me flying your helicopter, but I got a good pilot next to me, so I'm moving a stick around. We're doing a little of this, a little of that. And the fellow behind me is my successor, Assistant to the President of Homeland Security, Air Force four-star John Gordon. And I say to the pilot, does this helicopter have one of those engines that has a power failure rate 10 times that exceeds 10 times the limit that the FAA would impose on a commercial helicopter and put it on the ground until they fixed it? 10 times, folks. Pilot said, oh, yes, sir, we do, but it's a workaround. We try to work with it. And General Gordon behind me taps me on the shoulder and says, change the conversation. So practical, mundane, they need the help.
Another question.
I think we ought to have a purposeful discussion about a national ID card. Combat terrorism, crime, identity theft, fraud, use of biometrics generally, I think, right way will protect your privacy. I make some recommendations about a comprehensive. We don't have a southern border strategy, we don't have an immigration policy. So that's a list. Most of them are public policy decisions. There are some other recommendations that I've actually had been kind enough. Secretary Napolitano has reached out to me a couple times. I'm glad that we got a governor there because it may be a federal agency, but it's a national mission, and we need to build partnerships with the states and locals. So that's not a short answer to a very important question, but the longer answer is in the book. Not that I'm trying to get you to buy it.
Gentleman in the salmon right there.
First of all, is this working? First of all, Mr. Secretary, thank you very much for a lifetime of devoted public service. Thank you very much.
You're
and long
welcome.
May you speak out on these issues.
It's in my DNA.
Sir, my question is basically about jurisdiction. I'm curious to know about when or where the jurisdiction of the Homeland Security begins and ends, and how did you resolve conflicts between other overlapping security agencies, like federal governments or a state government?
Great question. I think you'll detect, without reading the book, let me just tell you that has been and will always be, at least for the foreseeable future, within the Department of Homeland Security, a challenge to figure out exactly how we fit because there's so much jurisdiction that overlaps. We have some international responsibilities. So technically we interface with the State Department, maybe with DOD from time to time, trying to identify specifically how we integrate what we need to do with what they're trying to do in their culture. Nothing wrong with that, trying to make the pieces fit. So it's a great question because in the war against these ideologues, in a war against these terrorists, there's so much overlapping jurisdiction. It's really done almost on an ad hoc basis. It's pretty clear the one jurisdictional area that we don't have primarily is intelligence gathering. We have very little responsibility there. None, actually, although the Coast Guard and Customs and Border Protection sometimes do that. So that's much easier. But the other is, as an example in there, where I talk about trying to get money from the Department of Defense. I thought it was their responsibility. They didn't think it was. We pushed, we shoved, we complained, we worked it. We finally got it. because we saw a statute that said we ought to have that reimbursement. So, again, the new agencies pushing up against a couple of old ones, they weren't resisting because they didn't want to help us. They just didn't think they either could or had the responsibility to do so. States and locals, I think there's a lot of shared responsibility. In my own mind, there were a lot of conflicts, but philosophical differences doesn't mean you're conflicted personally. But I know there are some people that don't think that we ought to give any money to the states for training, exercises, and equipment. I don't agree. I think it's a shared responsibility. After 9/11, we ought to support the governors and the mayors and the chiefs with some dollars. Now, we can put some of their own ways. On the other hand, I don't think we ought to be paying salaries for police and firemen. Some governors and mayors think we should. So there's that constant tension, good tension, in a political system as to who has responsibility or a jurisdiction over what. And it's always been that way when you got big government. And the federal system creates a lot of interesting questions you have to resolve.
Well, a follow-up question, then. Since your agency does not gather intelligence.
Yeah, we get it, though.
Was it freely and voluntarily provided to you?
Well, as you'll note in the book, that was part of the culture we tried to change, and I think we're fairly successful. We initially had some difficulty with some of the agencies. We worked them out. Not completely. I can't tell you 100% that we worked them out, but we went from rhetorical support to the notion. FBI is a great example. They became a counterterrorism agency, and Bob Mueller is a great public servant. He's a great friend of mine. But, you know, we needed to know from time to time, what do you guys know? What's going on out there? Because we think from time to time we need to share that with the locals. They said, well, we have these joint terrorism task forces in these communities, and we'll tell them ourselves. And we said, okay, well, we hope you do, but we need to know too. Well, we began working that out. We also began, after several months, to send out joint bulletins and advisory. So, again, it was a work in progress. There were a couple of times, I say in the book, that I was surprised to learn at our morning briefings that the FBI knew something I didn't know. So I remember after that, after a briefing, I said something to Bob Mueller, and he let me send one of my trusted advisors over to sit in on his briefings. So, again, it was a work in progress, a learning process, and I think we ultimately did a pretty good job with it.
Folks, we have time for a few more questions. Lady in yellow on the side there.
Hi, Governor Ridge. My name is Julia, and I'm a survivor of Katrina. I have a question for you. One of the most important events in your life as a politician and a person who wants to protect this country, what would you say that event was in the Homeland Security? The most singular event in your life. As a politician, what was the most important for you? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess probably as an elected official, I think I'm answering your question. I won my first congressional race by 729 votes out of 160,000 that were cast. Think about that. And I don't know where I'd be if the 729 votes would have gone the other way. I wouldn't be here talking to you. So from a politician's point of view, the fact that way back when some people had faith and thought that I could, as a Republican, win in a Democrat district, and they really worked very hard in order to accomplish that goal, as I look back, that would be it. Reminds me of a wonderful story. President Gerry Ford, again, one of great Americans, he told me, and if he was president of the United States, he told me in his own mind the most important thing that ever happened to him as elected official was being sworn in to the people's house, the House of Representatives, the first time. And so if you look back on anybody that's had the career that I've had, a political career, I think at least I go pivot back to that first election that I wasn't supposed to win. Didn't win by much, but 729 held up in court, so no big deal. I'm here.
Next question. Lady in orange right here.
My question is, given the international community, are there any other countries whose homeland security you respect and you think that we need to emulate more of what they are doing?
Did everyone hear the question about how? Okay, very good. You know, There's a great deal of not only information sharing, but best practice sharing with some of our friends and allies. I mean, we're constantly talking to Israel, Great Britain, several other countries, not only on intelligence and law enforcement, but, you know, are there potentially new technologies? Are there new approaches that have proven to be successful to you? I'd say that, and I think it's important to note, even some of those countries that really disagreed with us being in Iraq, below that public policy difference about that war, best practices, intelligence, law enforcement, we're niched up pretty good. So whenever we hear something out there that somebody might be doing something better or smarter, we normally reach out and talk to them about it. And it goes both ways. They come over and talk to us a great deal as well. A lot of interaction, tremendous amount of interaction in that fashion. To that end, well, I'll answer your question. You didn't want to ask for a monologue. We'll go to the next question.
Okay, gentleman in the green on the aisle.
Thank you very much, Governor. I just wanted to ask you about Katrina, and that seems like it's so far it's been the biggest test of our Homeland Security Department. Were you surprised by the way that Katrina was handled, the mismanagement, or did you feel it was mismanaged?
I write a whole chapter on it. And I'll tell you why. Back in 1985, you know, I draw on some of my experiences. Well, back in 1985, as I was a congressman in northwestern Pennsylvania, three tornadoes bounced around my district, wiped out three communities, killed a lot of people, caused several hundred million dollars worth of damage. And the second disaster to follow the first disaster was FEMA. It was really a civil defense agency at the time, kind of. You know, really born back in the Cold War days when you and I were hiding, well, you're too young, but when I was hiding under my desk in the event of a nuclear attack, and not that I got a good grade in physics, I realized hiding under your desk in the middle of a nuclear attack wasn't going to do any much good. You know, so much for being prepared. Anyhow, so I know the agency pretty well. The Stafford Act is something that I wrote. Interesting story about that in the book. And I think there was, it really undermined people's confidence in government generally. And the federal government and there's has to take part of that burden. But I got to tell you, I said earlier in response to somebody's question, security and preparedness is a joint responsibility. It's a shared responsibility, federal, state, and local level. And there weren't too many competent decisions made on a timely basis at the local or state level as well. You know those horrible pictures of all those people in the Astrodome? The federal government didn't tell them to go in there. Remember those buses sitting in the parking lot could have been used for excavation? The decision to keep them there and not excavate is not the federal government's decision. They called out the National Guard much, much later. That's not the federal government decision. So in my judgment in the book, and you'll read it, I'm pretty critical because I think personally there were some things that could have been done that weren't done. I talk about them. Couldn't prevent the levees from breaking. But I think looking back and reflecting, we could have reduced the heartbreak substantially. There's a great story in there about a Coast Guard pilot and a pocket full of muffins you might enjoy as well. There are a lot of heroes in that area, but the Coast Guard rescued about 35,000 people. Flying around in the night vision goggles and all that stuff, hazardous duty all the time. They don't care. There were Coast Guards, men and women and families that lost their homes and possessions because instead of hanging around to try to do something with that, they went to work. I'm just a shill for the Coast Guard. They need more resources.
Got time for one question. Lady right here in front.
One of the issues I see, I read in the paper, I look at the internet, I see a lot of things being published by the media that just seems like don't fit under the heading of the people's right to know. Operations of the CIA, different task forces within the FBI. Don't you think too much has been made of the people's right to know and there's just some things they don't need to know during a time of emergency?
It's a wonderful question, ma'am. as a democracy, we are probably more transparent than any other country in the world. I mean, we wash linen dirty or clean in public on a fairly regular basis, and I don't view that necessarily as a weakness. I'd rather live in a transparent world than not. I think there are certain acts and investigations and efforts that the government undertakes under the watchful eye many times of Congress, particularly the intelligence community, the Intelligence Committee, certainly under the eye of the Inspector General. And I'll say this, and you got a lot of investigative reporters out there who think that there's something going wrong. They seem to manage to dig it out. I mean, there was a great expose of some of the problems at Walter Reed Army Hospital about a year and a half ago. They won a Pulitzer, and I'm glad they got the Pulitzer. So you've got all kinds of influences in America, both external and internal to government, to try to make sure that the kinds of things you need to know about, you ultimately know about. But at the end of the day, I think you're right. I know the FBI is working very hard on counterterrorism, and they got their eyes on certain communities and certain places. You don't need to know. There are other things that are being done. They know, and the right kind of oversight internally. So it's always the balance. Balance what you're doing with the Constitution and the rule of law. Balance what you need to transmit. I mean, that's one of the reasons I felt bad about what I did in August when I lauded my friend the president for his leadership in the war, which I shouldn't have done, because that suggested something that didn't happen. And in this war, the credibility of government is always at peril, and you never want to erode that. And so I think there are times in order to maintain the credibility, there are certain things you need to share. But I don't think you ever want to be in a position to share those things that will undermine your ability to secure the country. And just be assured there's a lot of people looking over those folks' shoulders. It's just like the young woman asked me about investigations. Well, the Patriot Act was controversial. They set up guidelines to deal with some of the issues. But the Inspector General said, well, you're not following the guidelines. I'm going to blow the whistle. They did. They made the changes. So it's always will be a balancing act. And I think your insightful question points out some of the challenges that we had in the department and the government, regardless who the president is, will have in perpetuity. Great question.
Ladies and gentlemen, Tom Ridge.
All right. Thanks a lot. Well, that's all right. Thank you for the time. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.